Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
President Trump this morning on Twitter nicknamed former President Obama for the first time and called him Cheatin' Obama. Cheatin' Obama? That's a pretty lame nickname. You know what's a cool nickname? Stormy.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to author Tayari Jones, who takes a few more questions just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
President Trump celebrated Easter by ranting about immigrants as more key members of his cabinet are accused of corruption. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Yesterday was Easter, the holiest day of the Christian calendar, so Trump woke up bright and early and tweeted to his followers, Happy Easter. And all was right with the world for 90 minutes. And then Trump started raving about caravans of immigrants.
He says this, Border Patrol agents are not allowed to properly do their job at the border because of ridiculous liberal Democrat laws like catch and release. Getting more dangerous. Caravans coming. Republicans must go to nuclear option to pass tough laws now. No more DACA deal. Mexico is doing very little, if not nothing. It's stopping people from flowing into Mexico through their southern border and then into the U.S. They laugh at our dumb immigration laws. They must stop the big drug and people flows, or I will stop their cash cow, NAFTA. Need wall.
Ah, yes. Who could forget how Christ rose on the third day and said unto his followers, we gotta do something about all these Mexicans. Not that I'm surprised Trump doesn't embrace the spirit of Easter. I bet every kid who found an egg on the White House lawn is getting a bill within the next week. We have had terrible egg deals for too long. Kids have been taking our eggs. They've been laughing at us. They laugh. Oh, they laugh. In fact, Trump picked up right where he left off today at the annual White House Easter egg roll. His only job was to come out, say hello to the families participating, thank the First Lady, and thank the White House Historical Association. And yet he still could not stop himself from rambling, even about something as mundane as the White House itself.
I want to thank the White House Historical Association and all of the people that work so hard with Melania, with everybody to keep this incredible house or building or whatever you want to call it, because there really is no name for it.
No name for it. There's a name for it. It's the name everyone calls. It's the White House. I used to think you put your name on buildings out of pure ego. Now I think it's just so you can find them. You're talking to a crowd of even the children know what it's called. And if they hadn't learned it yet, you could just ask them to describe it and they'd still probably get the name right. Trump talks about the most famous building in the world like a nervous tour guide on his first day. And we call this the Pale Home. No, that's not right. I should have written this down. Duh! Trump continued to stammer away about the White House, insisting that he keeps it in excellent condition, but using one especially interesting turn of phrase.
It is special, and we keep it in tip-top shape. We call it sometimes tippy-top shape.
What is he doing? Trump talks like he's trying to distract a security guard while his friend steals a vase.
And then sometimes we call it tippity-toppity shape or tippy-shippy or tip-tap-chip-chap.
The weirdest part came when Trump started bragging, as he always does, about his supposed accomplishments. Now, remember, this is to an audience of young children who were just there to play games with eggs.
This is a special year. Our country is doing great. You look at the economy, you look at what's happening. Nothing's ever easy, but we have never had an economy like we have right now, and we're going to make it bigger and better and stronger. Our military is now at a level, will soon be at a level that it's never been before. It's you see what's happening, and you see what's happening with funding. The funding of our military was so important, and so many military people are with us today. So just think of $700 billion, because that's all going into our military this year.
Ah! What are you talking about? I'm shocked the children didn't start booing. Stop making us think about the military! We want eggs! Also, check out the Easter Bunny next to him. Even he can't believe what he's watching. You can order that costume on Amazon if you just search for Confused Easter Bunny. Somehow things continued to get worse because Trump then met with children at the event while reporters tried to get some clarity from him on what he was talking about in his nonsensical tweets. And again, he went off about DACA.
Mr. President, what about the DACA kids? Should they worry about what's going to happen to them, sir?
The Democrats have really let them down. They've really let them down. They had this great opportunity. The Democrats have really let them down. It's a shame. And now people are taking advantage of DACA, and that's a shame. It should have never happened.
Now, obviously, those kids didn't say anything, but if they did, I imagine it'd be something like, in order to qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, you have to have lived here continuously since 2007 and been under 16 when you arrived, which means no one arriving now would qualify for the program. And on top of that, you're the one who canceled it last year, after which you rejected multiple bipartisan compromises to save it. So what you're saying makes absolutely no sense. Now shut up and give us our eggs! But while Trump was rambling about immigration at Easter events, he was also dealing with a cabinet that's increasingly embroiled in scandal, like the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt. Pruitt has already come under fire for hiring an unprecedented 24/7 security detail that he used while on non-official business, including a family vacation to Disneyland. Although the trip to Disneyland became official business when Pruitt hired as his chief of staff this qualified individual. He now shares an office with this guy. Pruitt also racked up expensive first-class flights, and when questioned about those flights, his team justified them by claiming unruly passengers posed a security threat. An aide to Pruitt told Politico he was approached in the airport numerous times, to the point of profanities being yelled at him and so forth. An individual approached Pruitt with his cell phone recording, yelling at him, "Scott Pruitt, you're effing up the environment." I mean, if you can't handle profanity at the airport, then you can't handle the airport. I hear more cursing in the security line than I do in any three Scorsese movies. Spirit Airlines' slogan is good luck, ass. And now, on top of all that, Pruitt is also in trouble after it was reported that he rented a Capitol Hill condo at below market rates from the wife of a prominent energy lobbyist. But here's the weirdest part of this story. At one point, Pruitt's security detail couldn't get in touch with him, so they broke into the condo to check on him.
ABC News has learned of this bizarre incident at the apartment last year.
I need ambulance, please.
An urgent 911 call.
They just say he's unconscious and he's unresponsive.
Pruitt's protective detail breaking down the door. Inside, the cabinet secretary, unresponsive.
Mentioned three medics who responded, unconscious person.
The EPA is not commenting on the incident, but sources tell us Pruitt was just napping.
The security detail broke down the door because he was napping? What would they have done if he was taking a dump? Cut a hole in the ceiling to airlift him out? For now, Pruitt still has his job, but even when Trump fires cabinet secretaries, he does it in the most chaotic way possible. Just take his former Veterans Affairs Secretary, David Shulkin, who Trump fired via tweet last week. Last year, Trump was singing Shulkin's praises at the White House and publicly assuring him that he would never lose his job.
I also want to express our appreciation for Secretary Shulkin, who is implementing the dramatic reform throughout the VA. It's got to be implemented. If it's not properly implemented, it will never mean the same thing, but I have no doubt it will be properly implemented. Right, David? Better be David. We'll never have to use those words. We'll never have to use those words on our David. We will never use those words on you, that's for sure.
That was the worst experience anyone's ever had standing next to Trump. Until today. And now there's a weird legal drama unfolding over whether Shulkin resigned or was fired. The White House is now bizarrely insisting that the decision was actually Shulkin's, releasing a statement saying Secretary Shulkin resigned from his position as Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. But in a series of interviews this week, Shulkin has tried to make clear that that actually was not the case, without saying specifically that he was fired.
Were you fired or did you resign?
Well, Jake, I came to run the Department of Veterans Affairs because I'm committed to veterans. And I'm committed to fighting for them, and I would not resign because I'm committed to making sure this job was seen through to the very end.
So you were fired?
I did not resign.
Hello. I love the way he shakes his head yes while trying to avoid answering the question. He's like a hostage who knows Trump is watching. In fact, I'm pretty sure when he drank from his mug, there was a note scrawled on the bottom. So Trump is lashing out and brazenly lying about immigration as his inner circle dwindles and his cabinet comes under fire for corruption. In other words, his White House isn't exactly in
tippy-top shape.
There's been a closer look. Our guest is a critically acclaimed novelist whose fourth novel, An American Marriage, was published in February to critical acclaim. Please welcome to the show, Tayari Jones, everybody. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
I am thrilled to have you here. I want to talk about your wonderful book. I want to start with the title. You had some hesitation in calling it An American Marriage. How did you come to the conclusion that it was the right title for this book?
Well, I came up with the title. I was just brainstorming with my editor. And, you know, when they say brainstorm, they say you can say whatever comes to mind. So I just threw that out there. And he was like, I like it. And I was like, no, we're brainstorming. You're not allowed to like it.
Yeah.
And he says, well, why don't you like it? And I said, well, to me, An American Marriage sounds like a novel about some white people in Connecticut.
Yeah, sure.
Experiencing feelings.
Yeah.
And my editor, his name is Chuck, he's a very sober guy, and he says, Connecticut is a very small state. Why is it that you feel like what happens in Connecticut is more American than what happens to your characters in Atlanta? And I realized that I have never in my entire life been called American without being, you know, Black American or African American. So when I left it off, I felt like the story didn't have anything to do with me. So I went and I talked to my mentor, an Atlanta playwright named Pearl Clegg, and I said, Pearl, I just feel, and she says, I understand, but she's older than me, and she says, a lot of people made a lot of sacrifices for you to be able to say this is your home. This story is American. You're American. So if you want that title, you can have it.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm so glad you made the decision to keep it. This book is about racism. This book is about wrongful incarceration. But this incarceration. This book is also about a couple and how one moment changes their lives. How do you come up with an idea for a book like this?
Well, I knew that I wanted to try to write a book that engaged the issues of the day. So I wrote an application to do a year-long fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. And I did all this research on wrongful incarceration. And I was angry, I was outraged, but I wasn't inspired. You know, I'm a storyteller, I'm not an ethnographer. And I was really, the clock is ticking, the Harvard people, they want to see what I've been up to, and all I have is a bunch of, like, index cards and post-it notes. So I went to Atlanta to visit my mother and to do a little shopping. All these, both these things helped
me. Thank you, by the way. Thank you for coming clean on that, yeah.
And when I was in the mall, I saw a young couple. The woman was splendidly dressed. The guy, he looked okay, but she looked fantastic. And I heard her say, clear as a bell, she said, Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years. And I didn't know him, and I didn't know her, but I was thinking, you know, he probably wouldn't have waited on her for 7 years. And he said back, what are you talking about? This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place. And I was intrigued because you know you have a novel, not when you're writing about, you're supposed to write about people and their problems, not problems and their people. And in the mall, I knew I had my people.
And you also use letter writing, because obviously you have someone who's incarcerated, someone who's not, and they're communicating via letter. Is that something you knew right away would be a part of that? And you are a letter writer in real life. Is this true?
Yeah, I write about 5 or 6 letters a week.
How many do you get back?
Hardly any.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
I know. People do not write me back. But I keep hope alive, and I write all these letters. And so when I was writing between my couple, because, you know, they've only been married 18 months, and he's like, I'm going to write you a love letter every day from prison. And so you can see how their relationship comes together and falls apart from the way the letters go. Like, when she started signing them, like, yours truly, I knew it was over.
Yeah, there you go. You teach creative writing as well. Is there a piece of advice that you feel is the most helpful to give young writers when they're starting this path?
You know, I think this is the most helpful advice for writers, young, old, whatever, which is that you don't have to write every day. Because people always say, oh, a writer writes. And so people who don't have the free time to write every day, they think they can't be writers. But what does that mean if the only people writing our national story are people who have so much leisure time? The people who don't have time because they work, they have kids, they're doing elder care, I feel they have the most important stories. That's why they don't have time. They're busy.
Yeah.
And so I want to encourage busy people to know that they can be writers. It may take you longer to write your book than someone else, but your story is important and you can tell it.
That is fantastic advice. Correct me if I'm wrong, the day your book was published, you got some very exciting news, which is this was an Oprah's Book Club selection.
No, the day the book was published is when you got the news. I found out in October.
Oh, wow. So you had to keep it to yourself?
Yes, for 5 months. I couldn't tell anybody.
Really?
People would say, how's the book going? I would say, I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful. Hopefully. So you find out, and by the way, that's so great that that's the one person that if they said you can't tell anybody, I would not tell anybody.
No.
But you found out because she called you.
Yeah, she just rolled up on me. I was driving my car, and the phone rang, was a block call. Now, I'm the kind of person, I'm intrigued by block calls. I feel like that person blocked it for a reason. So I said, hello? And she said, hi, this is Oprah. So I pulled over. I put on my hazards. I pulled over.
You have to.
And I said, ma'am?
And you knew, I mean, because you would think somebody could prank call, but I bet her voice the minute, yeah.
No, anyone, you could hear it in your sleep and you would know that it was, that Oprah Winfrey was calling you on the telephone.
That's fantastic. Well, what a great call to get and well-deserved. Thank you so much for being here. It's just been a delight talking to you.
Thank you.
Carrie Jones, everybody. An American Marriage is available now wherever books are sold.
Hi, everyone. This is Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage with Tayari Jones, fresh off of your appearance on Late Night. Thank you for being here.
Hi.
And your new book, An American Marriage, it's so wonderful. I read an interview that you'd done about the difference between identity between black men and black women and how there's maybe a little bit of a wider range of expression for men than there is for women, in your opinion. Can you extrapolate upon that?
Well, you know, we were talking about when Celestial, my heroine, is testifying on behalf of her husband.
Yes.
And the lawyer tells her to, you know, give it up. This is no time to be articulate. It's time for you to be, like, more authentic. And she's She's kind of stymied because being articulate is the only way she's ever been able to communicate and be respected. And he wants her to be more kind of off the cuff. But in my opinion, that would not have been more effective because a kind of vernacular presentation doesn't give Black women the same kind of credibility of authenticity right. as men. I feel like men have a lot of ways that they can present and be respected. They can be kind of very formal, kind of button down type, like the Barack Obama model. But then there is kind of a more streetwise vernacular model that you see sometimes in Hollywood and sports. There's just a more of a range. They still have a more limited range than other people, but they have more choices on how they can present and be respected.
Did you find that was something you had to embrace when you were writing and something that you realized while you were writing, or that was something that was already fully realized for you before you started creating Celestial?
Well, Celestial and I have an awful lot in common. We have the same hometown of Atlanta. We both graduated from Spelman College. So kind of what she knows, I know.
Okay.
And I am a person who has always been told that, you know, you need to be articulate, you need to have impeccable grammar in order to be heard or seen at all.
We also talked about this idea of sort of collateral damage in terms of female versus male, and the view of Celestial changes for Roy once he's incarcerated. He likes the idea that she's independent and has her own business and is a person who wants to be a very successful woman, and then when he's incarcerated, that changes slightly.
Well, yes, I mean, that is the thing about Celestial that is lovable about her in the beginning. You know, she's got all this wild hair. She's this free spirit of a woman, and he loves that about her. But when he's incarcerated, he really wants a more traditional woman. I often joke and say that Roy wants what Odysseus wants in the Odyssey. You know, he wants to come home to a chaste woman and a clean home. I do feel like when the going gets tough, people get really conservative.
Yeah. The part that I really loved was you get this sense that Roy really isn't a bad guy. It's just more of circumstantial what happens to him, but that he does become this different person, obviously, in prison. And you do such a nice job of that shift through the letter structure that you use.
Yeah, Roy is a regular guy. He's a nice guy. He's ambitious. He's in prison for something he did not do. Mm-hmm. I think any of us would not be in the greatest mood, you know, under these right. circumstances. And he has a lot of anger. And he thinks that the way that he's going to free himself of his anger is by reclaiming what he's lost in terms of money, his wife, his house. But really, what he doesn't see is that what he needs to reclaim is his ability to empathize. And you can see in the letters that he's becoming increasingly, you know, self-centered because mm-hmm. he feels like all of his energy and resources have to be used to take care of himself. And he doesn't realize that he has anything left for anyone else.
What's been the most, I don't want to say interesting because I'm sure you've had such interesting feedback, but I guess memorable reaction to the novel of someone who's talked to you about it in terms of readers when you've gone and talked about this book?
What's been really interesting is that people who have had the experience similar to the characters and people who have not say similar things. You know, I've met a number of women who say, you know, I am Celestial. I had a boyfriend or a husband who was incarcerated and the challenges of it. But also I've had a woman say to me just in Houston, she says, I feel like I'm Celestial. She says, because I'm in a long distance relationship and prison is the ultimate long distance relationship. And that really made me see, though, that Celestial and Roy's problems are the same as other couples. It's mm-hmm. just turned up to 100. And the rest of us have these same troubles, you know, because in many ways she's having a work-life balance issue.
Right.
How will she nurture her marriage and also her career? The same issues as other people. It's just that for them, the stakes are super high.
Yeah, it's just heightened. Well, it's a tremendous novel. And I just wanted to end with, because I thought this was so funny, you told me that you use YouTube for a lot of different things. And I thought the most interesting was that you learned how to swim via a YouTube tutorial.
Yes, you can learn to swim on YouTube. You can. I learned how to swim on YouTube. I fix my coffee maker on YouTube. I've learned how to do my hair on YouTube. You can learn how to do anything on YouTube.
Well, I think maybe someday you should do some type of teaching over YouTube. But I know you said that maybe it doesn't translate.
No, writing is magical. You can't teach magic.
But you could just do some type of lecture series. People should hear your voice. You have a wonderful voice. And you have some wonderful things to say, too, I think.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for being here.
It was fun.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.